Hey everybody, Kevin here. Today's guest is Ryan Holiday. Ryan is the author of The Obstacle is the Way, also Ego is the Enemy, and most recently, The Daily Stoic. Today we talk Stoic Philosophy 101, which is actually a great place to start for me because philosophy was an elective in school and sadly one that I opted out of. So getting an introduction to this stuff with someone like Ryan, who's a deep thinker and an expert in this field, has been awesome. We also talk about Why Ego is the Enemy, which was a great book of his that I enjoyed and recommended to my newsletter subscribers here probably 6 or 8 months ago. We also talk about Ryan's daily habits, including his 5-year journaling and a whole lot more. But first, a quick reminder to sign up for my newsletter, which is called The Journal. The Journal is a once-a-month newsletter filled with the best of the web. I include my favorite articles, science links, productivity hacks, apps, and a whole lot more. It's only sent once a month, so I don't bombard you with ads or a bunch of extra emails. It's just one email a month, and you can sign up for that and join, I think, close to 80,000 people now over at thejournal.email. Let's get into our interview for today. This is Ryan Holiday. This idea of reading Stoic material as kind of like starting to take it into the mainstream. And I know that there's a lot of people that even today, even though it's becoming a trend, even today, some people are like, I have no idea what you're talking about when you start, when you bring it up. As someone that's written a book on the topic, I'd love to get your kind of 101 take on Stoicism. And what should people think about? Who are the Stoics? Like, give me the primer here.
It's interesting because it is becoming a trend and it's certainly popular now, but it's weird to think that if anything, it's a fraction of how popular it once was. Stoicism, it's a philosophy. I know when people hear philosophy, they think like, okay, so it's like this arcane, complicated explanation of the universe, or it's like these big ideas that, you know, make sense only to really smart people. Stoicism is like this practical philosophy. It's for people doing real things in the real world. And when it came up in ancient Greece and then made its way into ancient Rome, it was popular with generals and playwrights and ordinary people, even slaves. It's much more practical than people think. You know, Marcus Aurelius is probably the most famous Stoic that people can think of. You know, he's the old guy that Joaquin Phoenix's character kills in Gladiator. He's the emperor of Rome, and he's obsessed with this philosophy. It was, you might call it like a civic religion. Like, it doesn't say, it's not a religion in the sense that it has these certain gods and an explanation of the universe, but it's like a way of living and being. The best explanation I've heard is that it's a series of spiritual exercises. So it's things you remind yourself of, things you say, ways of thinking about common situations in life that help you deal with them. So it's closer to like Buddhism than probably any other Western philosophy, but its purpose then was to help Marcus Aurelius be the emperor and be a good person while he was doing so and be happy and not be afraid. And, you know, all the things that we experience as humans, it's there to help us with that.
Who would you consider to be the founding members here? Like, give me a timeline of all this.
The founding member of Stoicism is a guy named Zeno, who was an Athenian merchant in ancient Greece. And so the famous story is that he's got a load of his spices or whatever he's taking with him. And he's traveling and his convoy of ships is wrecked by a storm. He washes up in Athens. And there he's introduced to philosophy in general by a philosopher there. And he says famously, like, when I suffered a shipwreck, I found a great fortune. Like, what's interesting to me about Stoicism and why I think it's interesting that it's popular again in a business context is that it's founded by a businessman, you know, 2000 plus years ago. So we date it to ancient Greece. You know, it sort of trucks along there for a few hundred years, but it's really with the Roman Empire that we see Stoicism in the form that it's most recognizable, in that the Romans were us, right? The Romans were Westerns. It's empire, it's business, it's commerce, it's war, it's modern sort of capitalistic life. That's where the philosophy and what we recognize now as the modern world is coming. And Stoicism is right there at the core of it before Christianity has taken hold and had its influence on the course of obviously civilization.
So was this something that Zeno said, okay, I need to get a group of people together, philosophers together, to kind of expand this? Or did these individual Stoics kind of happen independently of each other?
It's a little of both. So it's not unlike how Plato is the student of Socrates and Aristotle is the student of Plato, mm-hmm. and Alexander is then the student of Aristotle. So it's this chain of individuals that have sort of passed this tradition along. So much of the Stoicism that survives to us was never even really written down as a comprehensive philosophy. It sort of survives to us in like snippets and quotes and dialogues. But Zeno begins to hold these lectures, these conversations on what's called the Stoa, which is porch. So it's basically these like porch front lectures and conversations between people who are suffering from the same problems, looking for the same solutions. And that's where the word Stoicism comes from, is this idea of the Greek Stoa.
If people are listening to this right now and they're like, okay, you've like intrigued me with this idea,
yeah,
of some amazing hidden knowledge that is, you know, a few thousand years old. Like, what are people learning? What are the teachings here?
The core tenet of Stoicism, I would say, comes from a line from Epictetus. He says, and Epictetus is a slave. So to back up for a second, what's interesting is you have Epictetus, one of the most prominent Stoic philosophers. He's a slave, and it's his journals, his teachings, that make their way to Marcus Aurelius, who's the emperor, and he falls in love with them. So it's this philosophy then that's like, for the absolute bottom and the absolute top, they're each still dealing with the same fundamental problems, and the same sort of framework is able to create relief and comfort and strength for both of them, which I find to be infinitely fascinating.
Yes.
But Epictetus is saying, you know, our first task in life is to distinguish between the things that are in our control and the things that are not in our control. That this is the essence of Stoicism, is saying, here are all these things that if unthinkingly I will be upset by, I will be angered by, I will expend energy trying to change. But if I actually sit down and break down whether they're in my control or not, they become irrelevant to me very quickly. Mm-hmm. Other people's opinions, you know, the weather, where you were born, that someone you loved has passed on, right? All these things that cause us distress, so much of them are completely out of our control. And so the Stoics are saying, well, look, first off, I could just give myself some clarity by distinguishing between what's in my control and what's not in my control. And second, it's a massive sort of strategic benefit, personally and professionally, to say, I'm only going to focus my energy on the things that are inside my control. Mm-hmm. And so that to me is the essence of Stoicism in a lot of ways. I would say like my sort of quick summation of Stoicism is, we don't control what happens to us, we control how we respond. Mm-hmm. And so that's what the Stoics are doing and teaching. Obviously, it gets much more complicated. There's many other lessons. But I think at the core, it's just going, people waste an incredible amount of their life obsessing about, being afraid of, being anxious of, throwing time and money at things that, if they were really honest with themselves, are completely outside their control.
Yeah, this is something that, like, as you pointed out, can just be applied to pretty much everything, even in modern life. I mean, for me, I remember so many years ago when I first started to learn how to drive, people would just be so upset and get road rage, mm-hmm. over daily traffic.
Yes.
And or someone cutting you off. And I was saying, for me, that always seems so silly, just because it's like, it's something that's going to occur every single day. There's absolutely nothing you can do about it. And so why even let it penetrate you in that way?
What I love about Stoicism is, from what I can recall off the top of my head, there's no like specific mention of traffic, but traffic would be a real concern living in Rome, trying to get from one side to the other, right? Like, they are talking about that exact thing. And so it's crazy. Like, you know, you go, what are these people 2000 years ago? What can they teach me? And there's this wonderful line from Marcus Aurelius where he's like, think about all the time in the past. And it's like, what do you have? It's people loving, fighting, hating, being afraid of getting old. You know, he lists all these things. He was looking backwards in the past 2000 years ago. 2000 years later, we're looking backwards in the past, and the same things are true. And humans are still wasting time and energy and feeling good being mad about silly things like traffic. And so Stoicism isn't, okay, the Stoics said that, so now you're not mad about traffic. But it's when you're, the idea is that when you're mad about traffic, you're supposed to sort of run through in your head, is this something that I control? Is getting mad about this making it better or worse? Who knows? Maybe it could make it better. Is it making it better or worse? What could I be expending this energy on instead? And sort of running through that kind of like checklist or process, it's just to prevent you from throwing good after bad.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, you could apply this to, let's just say, health, for example. Yes, you can worry about dying and cancer, things of that nature. You could say, am I eating a proper diet? I think that would be a valid thing to ask, mm-hmm. right? That's not considered excessive worrying. But just daily worry about health concerns or dying or things of that nature is probably out of your control, right? But there's little tiny things you can do to hopefully impact that outcome.
Yeah, I think you take someone like James Stockdale, who was a famous student of the Stoics. He's shot down in Vietnam. He spent 7 years in a prison camp. There's this fascinating book, I think it's called Love and War, that he and his wife wrote. And what's interesting about it is like, so she's stuck in America and her husband is in a camp. He's stuck in a camp and he can't do anything about it. And so both of them then are like, what can we do here, right? So she's like, well, prisoners of war in Vietnam are not recognized properly here because like we hadn't officially declared war in Vietnam. So, you know, she's going to try to call the president. She's going to get publicity. She's going to try to do what she can from far away to help her husband. But she's not going to spend every night crying herself to sleep and worrying. She's going to focus on what she can control. She's going to acknowledge that she feels stressed and scared and alarmed. She's going to have human emotions, but she's not going to spend her time balled up on the couch. She's going to try to change that. And for his part, he's going to say, okay, this is a challenge for me. I am in a horrible situation. At the very least, I'm going to I have to accept that. And then what can I do for the people around me, right? What can I do to make sure that I don't betray my country? What can I do to keep myself healthy? What can I do about the injuries that I have? There's so many things that are in your control that focusing on them will keep you plenty busy, that say feeling sorry for yourself or feeling angry or, you know, I think where we expend a lot of energy, sometimes my wife and I talk about this, like when we're arguing, let's say I'm upset. And I'll say, you know, I'll express why I'm upset and she'll apologize. And then, you know, maybe I'll express why I'm upset again. And then she's like, well, what do you want? And I will often catch myself going, well, what I want is for it not to have happened, right? Like, oh, I want this situation right. not to have happened.
Too late.
Which is an absurd thing to be mad about. And so like realizing that helps oftentimes will just sort of cut all the anger away. Because if I fool myself and I go, you know, being mad and continuing to express why I'm mad, maybe that will get someone to see how I feel, or, you know, maybe that will, you can fool yourself indefinitely that being upset is making a difference.
How do you,
but in reality, it's not.
But how do you, let's just say, you know, there's a lot of, I think that comes out in kind of venting, like this idea
yes.
of being able to blow off steam, like, I would worry that at some point you're just kind of pushing things down and saying, okay, well, I'm just going to bottle this up because I'm not supposed to be mad. Like, how do you kind of reconcile the two?
I think that's a great question. Have you read any of Nassim Taleb's stuff? He wrote The Black Swan?
Yes. A long time ago, though, when it first came out.
Yeah. So he's a big fan of the Stoics and he has a great line. He says, you know, Stoicism is not the absence of emotion. It's the domestication of them. So it's not about like suppressing them. It's about sort of controlling and directing them, I think. So the question would be, is venting at someone you care about a good way to let off steam or emotions? Or is it better to do it working out or writing it down? Lincoln was famous for, if he was really upset at someone, he would write them a long letter explaining exactly why he was upset, what they did wrong, what he wants to do about it, you know, all these things. And then he would put those letters in a drawer and then never send them. So he's not bottling it up, but what he's not doing is fooling himself that telling someone how angry he is with them is changing the situation at all. Because in reality, it's often making it worse, right? It's the anger that then creates resentment on the other end. Now that person is angry that you're angry, and it creates this whole sort of explosion. And so I think what the Stoics are doing is not saying don't have any emotions. They're saying, use your emotions productively and don't be whipped around by them. Don't like be led by them. You should lead your emotions, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we have focus on things you control. What are some other kind of key anchors that the Stoics have given us?
If you split it up into three disciplines, I'd say the three disciplines of Stoicism are perception. So that's like how you see the world. So, you know, what's in your control versus not your control. That would be the sort of, that would be an exercise of perception. You know, seeing things objectively, this is a perception part of things. You know, the Stoics would say, Marcus Aurelius would like to look at like fancy, expensive things and try to tell himself what they really were. So like expensive wine is like fermented grapes, or, you know, this like roast pig in front of you is just like a dead hog. Not so he doesn't enjoy them, but he's trying to make sure that he's not obsessed by material or external things.
This is cool. Right? I want to go down this rabbit hole a little bit.
Okay.
So let's talk about so many things to ask you about here. So how do you make purchases? How do you decide how do you decide when something's worth spending money on? I feel as though one of the biggest issues that we have, especially in the United States, is this attraction to money and wealth and private jets and whatever it may be. And there's like this obsession over, I must have more, I must make more money at all costs.
Well, and what's fascinating is like, that is also not new, right? So Seneca is one of the richest men in all of Rome. Marcus Aurelius, incredibly wealthy as the emperor of Rome. So, and they talk, it's almost like they talk more about how to struggle with those things than they do with like how to struggle with not having those things. So this is very much an essential part of Stoicism. I would say for me personally, I think about a couple of things. I think one of the essential tenets of Stoicism is that your stuff says nothing about you as a person, right? Mm-hmm. And if you can come to terms with that, it makes having nice things easier and also makes having them less important, if that makes sense. So it's like, if you realize that a car is just a car and not a reflection of you as a human being, that you're rich, it's not a reflection that you're smart, it's not a reflection that you have good taste, it's just a way to get around. It then allows you to go, okay, I like how this car looks, that's the one I want to have and I can afford it, so fine.
But wait a second, so many people would say, oh man, I got to have that Range Rover because it projects something about myself. Like, isn't right. there a like little pre-hurdle? That's a really hard one for people to get past, you know, like, they like things. I mean, the reason why there's so many people with Louis Vuitton bags is because, you know, it's not because of the high end quality. I mean, they make, granted, that they might make a great product, but I think that people look for that logo, that stamp, that like, I've made it. You know, how do you resolve that?
You're right. It's a very big hurdle to get over. Maybe I'm jumping through it, but I think what the Stoics are trying to get, or they're trying to remind themselves, are what the, first off, if we'll go to that exercise from Marcus Aurelius, he's trying to remind himself what it actually is, mm-hmm. right? So for instance, the emperor of Rome is the only person who's allowed to wear the color purple. So we call becoming emperor means assuming the purple. So it's this special kind of cloak that the emperor wears. And Marcus, in one of these exercises, he reminds himself that the purple cloak he wears is just an ordinary cloak dyed with shellfish blood. That's how they would get the color purple. And so he's saying like, look, this is just and so I think one of the ways you can sort of break that sway of those things having over is realizing what they are, right? It's like, oh, this bag is just, you know, a bunch of leather sewn together by some person in a sweatshop in China, right? And obviously it's more than that because it might actually be a well-made product. But the point is, seeing it from this sort of absurd caricature, this sort of like deliberately finding the fault in it, lets you sort of even out the marketing and the natural human tendency to want this thing that other people have. So that's one of the ones that I look at a lot. They talk about like how many sort of dumb, gross, horrible rich people there are, not to make you not want to be rich, but to sort of deliberately break any illusions that having money says something about you as a person, right? The reason people want money is that they think that money bestows upon them respect and that they're smart, that they obviously earned it, you know, all these things. It's really the assumptions that money has that people want. And I think if you can look for counterexamples to those assumptions, they help you a little bit there too. Anne Lamott has this line, and I think she took it from someone else, but she says, like, ever want to know what God thinks about money, just look at the people he gives it to. And so I think if you realize that they're just ordinary people, maybe even flawed people, you're not so motivated to join their ranks. All that being said, though, I don't think there's anything objectively bad about having money or being successful. The Stoics certainly didn't think so. The point was to lessen our identification with it, mm-hmm. and to lessen our dependence on it. So Seneca's very rich, but he justifies this by saying, I'd be just as happy not having any of this. But since I do have it, I'm going to enjoy it and make the most of it.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on experience stretching? Do you know much about that?
Walk me through what you mean by it.
So I've heard of this term experience stretching, whereas let's just say, for example, you go out and you see the most beautiful sunset. You're like, wow, that was just a beautiful sunset. And the next night the sunset occurs again. And this time you have a glass of, like, you know, 18-year whiskey with you, and you're drinking the whiskey and looking at the sunset. And you're like, wow, this is definitely the most beautiful sunset. And this whiskey is amazing. And sure. The next night you do the exact same thing, but you add a cigar into the mix. You're like, wow, this Cuban cigar with this whiskey and the sunset, I mean, can't be topped. And then all of a sudden that initial sunset wasn't so beautiful because you have stretched out this experience to a point where you can't be happy unless you have fulfilled all of these things.
Yes, I think that makes sense. One of the interesting things from the Stoics is you might argue that they tried stretching in the other direction,
which I think is fascinating. This is what Tim Ferriss practices when he wears his horrible dress shoes. Have you seen him do any of these exercises?
Yeah. And that comes from Seneca. You know, Seneca said he would try to practice poverty once a month and go, hey, is this so bad? You know, is this what I was afraid of? Cato, who's another famous Stoic, he's the one who challenges Julius Caesar when Caesar makes himself emperor and ends the Roman Republic. He would walk around bareheaded without shoes on, in, you know, crummy clothes, to sort of inure himself to people's criticism, discomfort, etc. Look, I think they're really interesting as theoretical exercises. I do try to practice them from time to time. What I just try to think about is, like, what's my baseline? Like, if I can have a baseline that's like, I think about how I grew up, which was like middle class. You know, my dad was a police officer. My mom was a school principal. We had nice things, but we didn't have really nice things, you know? Mm-hmm. So there wasn't anything that I didn't want or that I wanted for, but then there wasn't ever a sense that I could have whatever I wanted whenever I wanted it. So I've tried, as I've become successful and as my books have sold and, you know, I've done well, I've tried to really keep that as my baseline all the time. Like, I try to live in that world. I try to even remember, like, the numbers that I would hear of, like, you know, what was expensive to my parents, or, you know, what a house cost to my parents, or what a good salary was to my parents. And I've tried to keep that as my baseline, not stretch, as you're saying. Mm-hmm. I think what's really dangerous, more practically, this is less philosophical, what's really dangerous is to be ratcheting up what normal is as you become successful, because you can end up very far from where you were and not feel like you've changed at all. And then what the Stoics would say, this makes you very vulnerable to changes in fate or fortune, and thus makes you nervous and anxious about that potential change happening.
Right.
So, you know, if all of a sudden, if tomorrow I had $1 billion, obviously that would change my life in some ways. There's things I would do, but I would like to think that for the most part, I would stay, the things I like are the things I like. I'm not living how I live now, pining for these things that if I then got, I would go, you know, how could I ever go back?
Right. Yeah.
Like, for instance, I have a flight this afternoon and they upgraded me to first class from miles or whatever. I always think whenever I fly first class, even though I could probably afford it normally, I always think, don't get used to this. Remember, like, when you were a kid, you were just excited to be on an airplane, right? And so, like, I'll think as I'm sitting in this chair, you know, this is not that much better than sitting a few rows back. Like, this meal is gross. I'm just sitting here reading a book. I don't need any of this stuff. So obviously this is not like some huge life-changing exercise, but it's just remembering not to be changed by the things that are changing around you. It makes you able to enjoy success without becoming worse. And it also allows you to endure adversity without being sort of disappointed or crushed by it.
I love these examples. I this is certainly something that I try to incorporate in my life as well, are little tiny hacks on ways that I can just remember to be grateful and really kind of keep things in balance. You know, when it's winter, I shared this on your newsletter, by the way, or your blog post. What's that site, by the way? Is it dailystoic.com?
It's dailystoic.com. And yeah, it sends out an email. So the book, you read one page a day, and then there's also an email that goes out once a day that's another thought.
Yeah, signed up for that newsletter as well. It's great.
Thanks.
But you did a blog post, and I was talking about wearing sandals in the snow.
Yes.
And it's funny. It's like that serves a couple purposes. One, it kind of tries to temper me a little bit more and get me used to cold conditions. But also, I was reading about that. I don't know if you remember the Iceman that they found frozen in the ice.
Yeah.
Yeah, so his shoes that he was wearing at the time were just like pieces of leather kind of patched together with straw pushed in them. And I was thinking, like, how brutal that must have been to walk around in these snowy conditions with just a little bit of straw and some leather. So, you know, I try to kind of duplicate and kind of replicate that during the winter months, just to see, one, to kind of push my own body and endurance, but also to remember that we didn't always have it so good, you know?
Totally. I think cold showers aren't like... I think the Stoics would definitely have been proponents of cold showers.
Awesome.
So I'm a runner, so I run. I've worked to the point where, like, I could run on the surface of the sun, right? Like, there's no like condition that I can't run in, which took work and it took, you know, some brutal, terrible days. But now I have the freedom to be the Stoics. There's this word indifferent that the Stoics use a lot. And what's funny is, like, so many of the words in Stoicism have really negative connotations in today's society, which I guess shows how far we've gotten. You know, like, the Stoics say, like, passions are bad. And today we say, like, find your passion. They say, like, indifferent is like the highest good or the highest state you can attain. But we don't want anyone to be indifferent about anything. The Stoics want to be indifferent to things that are outside their control. And by that, they just mean, it is what it is. So if it's 110 and I was going to go running, I'm going running because I don't care. If it's 7 degrees and I committed to go running, I'm going running. And it takes work to get there, but it's a place of freedom, because then that's one less environmental factor that you're thinking about. Like, oh, I was going to go, but I can't because it's raining.
Right.
It's like, I run if it's raining or snowing or it's hot outside. That's what I do. And so that, to me, that's a form of freedom and a really great place to get to. Even though the word seems to be negative, it's actually quite positive.
That's awesome. Yeah, I'm trying to think of some of the kind of modern things we could do. We could probably put a bandwidth limiter on our computers, make it simulate an old 28.8 dial-up modem or something to remember the old times.
One that I do, like, when I fly, I've never bought Wi-Fi on an airplane. Like, I just pretend that I live in the world where before that was an invention, which was not that long ago. And I use it as really productive, quiet time. And I deprive myself of a luxury on purpose. And so I think the Stoics would say to live below your means, probably technologically, financially, comfort-wise, etc., because it's giving you a buffer, essentially. You know, if things ever really got bad, you know, like, if you actually did go to Antarctica, you would wear great stuff, but you would be more comfortable than the person who hadn't done the kind of training that you had. And I think it's the same way with sort of, oh, I live below my means. Great. That gives me a safety net if something ever happens. And it means that I'm not obsessing about competition with these other people because I've opted out of that game altogether.
How does one find drive and motivation and this willingness to win, but at the same time not play that game?
That is a really good question. And I don't think it's easy. I think you have to find some deeper, larger motivation. The Stoics talk a lot about duty. It's interesting to think, you know, Marcus Aurelius wanted to be a philosopher, and he wasn't born to be emperor. He was chosen. The emperor Hadrian picks Antoninus as his adopted son on the condition that Antoninus in turn adopts Marcus Aurelius. So it's basically, it's like he's this prodigy who people see a lot of talent and potential in, and he's chosen almost against his will to be the president or to be the emperor. And so this is not the course that he wanted for himself, but it was what he felt he was obligated to do. And then he was doing it. So I think my modern interpretation of that is that we all have certain talents or strengths or inclinations, and we owe it to ourselves to get as good as we can at those things. So to me, I feel like at some point I got bit by this writing bug, and I'm going to take it as far as it's going to take me. I'm not going to abandon it. I'm not going to ignore it because of this reason or that reason. But I'm not also going to try to do 25 other things at the same time. So there's a certain amount of sort of duty and discipline and sacrifice to it that I think is I identify with in Stoicism and I like. I don't think there's any conflict between Stoicism and ambition, mm-hmm. provided that the ambition is rooted in what you control. There's a quote from Marcus Aurelius where he says, like, ambition is tying your well-being to what happens to you. Self-indulgence is, you know, tying it to what other people say. Sanity is tying it to your own actions. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I want to write the best book that I can, that can reach as many people as it can, that can be the highest expression of my talent.
Mm-hmm. I think you nailed it right there, the highest expression of your own talent.
Exactly. And then you want to be indifferent in some ways to the part of the results that are outside your control.
Right. Because as long as you actually, you know, hold on, let me pull this up. I had a quote from you from Ego is the Enemy that I absolutely loved. You said, your potential, the absolute best you're capable of, that's the metric to measure yourself against. Your standards are, winning is not enough. People can get lucky and win. People can be assholes and win. Anyone can win, but not everyone is the best possible version of themselves. At the end of the day, that's all you can really do, right?
Completely. I'll give you a story of this. One of my favorite books is Confederacy of Dunces. Have you ever read this book?
No.
Okay, it's probably the funniest novel ever written. It's hilarious. It was written by this guy named John Kennedy Toole, and it was rejected by his agent and his publisher, and he kills himself. He's so despondent by their rejection. And his mother then finds the book, gets it published after his death, and it wins the Pulitzer Prize.
Wow.
And only like a very short amount of time elapses between all these things. And so to me, that's a very sobering idea. And it's the danger of letting somebody else decide whether your thing is good or not. The same book was said to be unpublishable and the greatest book in the world that year within a very short amount of time. And so as an author, what's interesting is, like, clearly selling best is not in any way an indication of quality, because we all admit lots of really terrible books sell lots of copies. Clearly, critical reception is often not even tied to sales. And there are many books for many different types of people. So you realize that unless you want to be miserable, or unless you want to be a slave to this profession, that the only way you can be happy is to have like an inner scorecard mm-hmm. of what's good or a fulfillment of your potential, or however you want to describe it.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, it's the best way to sleep at night too, right? If you went out there and you just gave it your all and you left everything out there on the field, like that, then you know there's no other outcome that could have taken place. Like, you gave everything that you had.
Absolutely. And look, sports are a great analogy for this, because some of my books have become popular in professional sports. So I've gotten to talk to a lot of professional coaches, and it's like, in a great baseball season, you're going to lose 60 plus games. You know, to go 500 in the NBA means you're going to lose like 41 games. That's crazy. So athletes get much more comfortable with the idea of putting it all out there and still losing. Whereas, like, with an author, you might only put out a few books. So you're so much more invested in the outcome. And even like with investments, you know, you're only going to do so many, but the more comfortable you can get with the idea that, like, all the information that I have right now says that this is a good call, and I know I'm making this call for good reasons, you have to open yourself up to the possibility that you could be completely wrong, or that fate could intervene and turn this obvious win into a huge loss. And you can't take that home with you and feel like a failure. So I think, again, these are the kind, to me, these are the kinds of questions that philosophy is designed to help us with. And that these are the kinds of questions that people have been struggling with since the time humans began having thoughts. And we can benefit from the smartest people who have sort of written some of those thoughts down. So that's all the first discipline. The second discipline is the discipline of action, right? So that's like what you do with this information. Mm-hmm. You know, are you acting with energy and determination and selflessness and kindness? You know, what's actually motivating what you're doing, right? So to use stoicism to become some sort of sociopath is not the end goal, right? It's, you're supposed to do good things that you believe in that are part, you know, the Stoics talk about this idea of like, we're all part of the same whole. Marcus writes, he writes this to himself. He's, you know, what injures the hive injures the bee, what injures the bee injures the hive. And he's saying, you know, like doing something that's good for you, but bad for everyone else, it's not the right thing to do. These are, again, moralistic ideas, but rooting them in logic, not in spiritual concepts. So that's a really important discipline, obviously. The final discipline is the discipline of the will. So that's the coming to terms with those things that are outside your control. That's preparing for difficulty and problems and heartache and setbacks. You know, the Stoic idea I love is this concept of amor fati, which means a love of fate, like an embracing of everything that happens to you. To me, that's a, you know, that's Marcus Aurelius late in his reign is betrayed by one of his closest generals. And the general tries to make himself emperor. And so, you know, Marcus could have been angry. He could have set out to get vengeance against this person. Instead, he tells the Roman Senate, like, and his generals, he says, look, this is an opportunity for us to show how we as a country can deal with civil strife. And we're gonna deal with this as peacefully as we can. And we're not going to become worse than the people who have wronged us in this way. He basically, it's like, even on a grand scale of being emperor, he's using being betrayed and trying to be usurped as an opportunity to practice forgiveness and unity. That's what the Stoic does. The Stoic tries to see everything that happens to them as this opportunity to be better, to do more things. And so that's the, I think, the hardest discipline of Stoicism, but ultimately the most profound.
What does it look like for you and kind of being, you know, embracing Stoicism? Does that make its way into kind of, you know, journaling or things that you do day to day?
Yeah, I certainly try. I would probably preface all of this by saying, you know, like, I'm not a monk in any way. I'm not perfect at any of these things. I write about them because I'm trying to work on them, that I'm trying to understand them to be better in my own life. But yeah, I try to wake up early.
How early is early?
Early is like 6:45, 7 for me. I have a 7-month-old, so it's a little unpredictable.
Oh, wow.
Right now. But
congrats.
We wake up. You know, we go for a walk together. We just sit outside and just sort of be quiet together. Then I usually come up to my office. I write in a journal. I have two journals. I'm actually in the middle of making a journal that's going to be hopefully solve some of these Stoic problems. But I write in one journal. It's called the 5-year journal, where I write like one sentence per day on the reflection of the day that just happened. And then I write in my other journal.
Reflection on the previous day.
Yeah, I reflect on the previous day.
Okay. And these are paper journals, I take it?
Yes. Yes.
So you don't use like One Daily or whatever? You don't use any of the online journals or any of the apps or anything?
I basically do nothing online except for publish my work. Like even when I research books, I do all my research on 4x6 physical note cards. So I'm like a paper junkie. Mm-hmm. The Stoic journaling concept is you reflect on the day just passed and you prepare for the day ahead.
Okay, so one sentence in a journal called the 5-year journal that is the previous day's actions. How do you reflect on a single sentence?
I'm just trying to remember what's happening, right? Like to me, it's, I'm trying to combine it with, so if that's the Stoic concept on one hand, there's another sort of technique in writing called morning pages, where writing is just the writing you do in the morning is just sort of a loosening of the muscles. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's less, I'm not trying to be that philosophical in my morning journaling so much as I'm just trying to get going. But so I kind of reflect on the day before. Then in the journal, I write about something that I'm grateful for, like some form of gratitude that I'm practicing. I try to write it. Lately, I've been trying to write it. It's so easy to say like, oh, I'm grateful for this good thing. I've been trying to write gratitude towards things that I would probably try to characterize as negative, like what I'm learning from something that I maybe didn't want to happen or some negative encounter. I try to also keep in my journal like what my workout schedule has been. And then I write about what's been happening and what I have coming up ahead and like notes for myself on, you know, hey, I feel like maybe you're working a little. I'm sort of addressing that journal to myself about things that I'm trying to work on or be better with. And so that probably takes 5 to 10 minutes. If I was a normal person, and this is going to sound weird, if I was a normal person, my journaling technique would be different because I wouldn't also be able to publish my thoughts, like what I'm struggling with on a larger scale. I wouldn't be able to publish them publicly, you know, one or two times a week. So my public writing routine influences a little bit what I journal. But the point for me is that I want to have quiet time alone with my thoughts, reflecting on what's happened and preparing for what might happen ahead.
And so how long does that end up being in terms of your time commitment and then also length?
Like I probably do 2 pages in the journal. Maybe 5 or 10 minutes. It's very quick. Mm-hmm. The other essential part of my routine then is comes later in the afternoon. I do some period of extensive physical exercise, usually of like a cardio nature for between 45 minutes and an hour. So running or swimming. And then I try to have the other thing that I think is part of my philosophical routine is that I try to do a long walk every day that I don't consider exercise. Hmm. So the walk has to be, I'm outside, I'm experiencing nature, it's quiet, and I'm out thinking, but I'm not, you know, I'm not doing anything else.
Are you thinking about work or is this more of a kind of walking meditation type thing?
It's a little bit of both. I tend to find that during the walking meditation, I solve work or writing problems, but usually because I'm not consciously trying to. Mm-hmm. So the solutions just sort of come into your, it's like I'm very intense. So I try to be very intense and then I try to take my foot off the intensity and then I'm often surprised by what happens.
And then how about any other things that you implement during the day or at night?
I try to have a significant amount of time of reading as well. And I'm trying to read books that have some practical value in my life. So I'm trying not to read some brand new book about business. I'm trying to read something old that's teaching me about a great person. Like I try to read a lot of biographies. I try to read philosophical works, try to read fiction. I try to make sure that I see reading as an essential task, not something that I do when I have a little bit of time left over.
And is this paper books or are you going into doing audiobooks as well?
Only physical paper books for me.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
it seems to me that the trend these days is just to do audiobooks and kind of put them at 1.5 speed, you know, or 2x speed and jam through them. I find my retention isn't quite what it should be when you just go pure audio at double speed.
I agree with that, and then I find myself doing other things. So then I'm not really reading. I'm trying to fit reading in while I'm doing something else. Mm-hmm. So for me, I'm going to be sitting down with a book. I want to have a pen. I want to be marking up the book when I read. So I was really excited about, you know, like Kindle when it came out. I was like, oh, you can annotate and save all these notes. To me, the process of reading a book, then putting it down, and then going back through that book to record those notes into some sort of physical system is another part of the meditative process for me, which I usually do on the weekends. So I usually have I'll let a stack of books accumulate, and then over the weekend I'll go through a couple of them, and I'm transferring all the things that struck me. I'm either typing out the passages to print out and put on note cards, or I'm writing them out by hand.
That's funny. When I first purchased, I had Ego is the Enemy on audiobook, and then I went back and actually bought a physical copy so I could do just that, like make notes, highlight certain phrases. For some reason, I just don't find that Kindle has, you know, you can do the highlighting, but it's just not the same. It's, you can't flip through it easily.
Yeah.
It's hard to reference.
Totally. And I think it was Hemingway, might have been Hunter S. Thompson. He used to just type out passages of great literature so he would like know what it felt like to have them go through him. Like, so he would say like his fingers knew what it felt like to write great stuff. And to me, the writing down these things is sort of that, it's like becoming a conduit for these forces that are better than what I'm capable of.
Makes sense. How about anything at night before preparing to go to bed? No screen time? Like, do you have any rules like that in the household, or how does it work?
I'm not as good at it as I should be. I try to sort of wind the day down. Since I get up early, I try to wind the day down, you know, like no more work, maybe 7 or 8, like it's sort of done. And then I'm spending time with my wife or spending time with our animals, or maybe we're walking, we're putting the kid to bed. We have like a routine with the kid. I try to make sure my one email thing is that I don't check email before I do anything in the morning. So like I want to put the phone down and then not pick it up during the night. And then I want to start my routine in some substantive way before I get sucked into the business of the day.
That's awesome. You know, I've thought about creating an app actually, and sadly it would only work on Android. It wouldn't work on iOS, but one that would put you into kind of I almost call it like a technology fast. Mm-hmm. And so you could tap a little button and it would show that you're doing a tech fast. It wouldn't allow you to browse. It wouldn't allow you to check email. And then you could kind of go for your own personal best. Like I made it 8 hours and 7 minutes or whatever it may be.
No, that's great.
And then if anyone wrote to you, like either via email or via text, they would get an automated response saying that their person is doing a technology fast. And then they could punch through that wall if they wanted to. So if they said, no, this is really important, I need to get a hold of Kevin right away, they could then have a method to like, you know, break through. But just this idea of being kind of in a fast mode could be pretty awesome. I was looking at and met with these founders of a product called the Light Phone. Have you seen this?
No.
So the Light Phone is essentially this little tiny thin, probably 1/3 of the size of an iPhone that just slips into your pocket. And all it is a telephone. And so you get a separate SIM card with it, and you can forward your number to that, but it won't allow you to text. It won't allow you to check email. You know, it's the perfect, like, I want to be disconnected, but still have the emergency kind of lifeline if I need it, you know?
Sure.
So it's an awesome little device if you're trying to get away from the technology, which I've been desperately trying to do for a long time.
I have a couple little ones. Like I found like the Apple Watch makes me check my phone for the time less, mm-hmm. which makes me then waste less time on the phone. I don't have any social media on the phone except for Instagram, because I can really only be on the phone, which I have hidden in a far folder that's like hard to get to. Because I found that like, and you probably remember this era very well, when social media first came out and it was on the desktop, I found it was very easy to manage and it wasn't an intrusive, overwhelming part of my life. Mm-hmm. But it's when I started to take it with me that it became more of a problem than it was a solution. And so I try to keep all of that on the computer rather than on my phone.
Yeah.
So I really just pay way too much. I really shouldn't have an iPhone. I should have this Light Phone that you're talking about, but I get lost a lot. So I need Google Maps.
Well, the next version of the Light Phone is going to have just like a very simple mapping feature as well.
Oh, that's great.
And potentially the ability to like hail a Uber or Lyft as well, which I think is perfect. Like that's all I need. Give me those few things that I'm set.
And I've found too, I've decided like email is my work medium and phone is, I don't get that many calls, so I'm only calling out, so that's easy. And then I try to keep texting it's like for friends only. So that way, like I know email is work and I know texting is for fun. And then I know phone is, you know, for work or whatever, but that way I'm not like some people, like they're G-chatting you and they're calling you and they're texting you and they're emailing you. And it's like, I'm trying to limit the amount of channels that I'm accessible mm-hmm. by. And by doing so, I make it, I'm, eliminating myself from getting addicted to those things, and I'm eliminating the channels that I have to monitor. And I found that lets me focus a little bit more.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. It's interesting that you wear an Apple Watch, because when I first got my Apple Watch, I absolutely hated it because it was just annoying me with push after push after push of various different things. And I recently got a new one, and I did it for the fitness tracking, but then I still kept getting annoying. And so I went into the settings and I turned off every single push notifications, not a single thing. The only thing that breaks through is a phone call, which is kind of nice, because if your phone's somewhere else and you want to see, you know, when mom's calling or whatever, but it's actually quite a good device when you turn off all the notifications.
It's very expensive for what it then is, but yes, I totally agree.
Well, I use it for tracking glucose levels as well. So I have a continuous glucose monitor that goes on my side for all the body hacking stuff that I do.
Right.
So for me, it's like the ultimate, like, you know, health device. But yeah, it is a little pricey for just that.
The other thing I use it for is the calendar alerts. So it's like I don't have to keep track of time as much. I just know, like, it's going to text me, or it's going to bump me 10 minutes before I have to start thinking about what I might have in the calendar next.
I should turn that on.
That one's pretty good. But all the other alerts, the only other alert I get is when it tells me that I've been sitting down for too long.
Yeah, I have that turned on as well. And I have the breathing exercises turned on. I guess I have a lot of stuff turned on.
None of those are work things.
Right. Except,
other than the calendar, which is you were already supposed to do that. So it's just not forgetting something.
Right. That makes sense. So I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I'd love to touch on Ego is the Enemy. I think that's, it was such a great read. And I had posted it out to all of the journal, my newsletter that goes out. And I know I got a lot of feedback back from that, saying that people really enjoyed it. So what was your inspiration behind creating this book? Like, what happened in your life? There must've been something, right?
There definitely was. I mean, I was a director of marketing at American Apparel, and around the time that I was thinking about my next book, the company began to implode. And during the time I wrote it, it went from being a company worth hundreds of millions of dollars to declaring bankruptcy twice and going to zero. So there was a real part of that. And there was some other stuff in my life where I saw, you know, sort of relationships with people I admired really sort of tear themselves to pieces too. So it was that, but then also just the historical trend of we tend to think that it's like the hard charging, arrogant, egotistical, asshole personality types that accomplishes everything. But the truth is, many of the most successful people I know are the most humble and the most open and helpful and nice. And those people, by definition, aren't out promoting themselves as much. And so I wanted it to be a book that's sort of illustrating the quiet virtues that I think are much more admirable in people, and to talk about how often difficulties that we face are not from the outside world, they are self-inflicted. And, you know, obviously I didn't predict the Trump presidency, but clearly, you know, ego is a role both in, you know, in Hillary's campaign, which was unsuccessful, and in the disaster that has been, you know, the Trump 5 or 6 months in office. You know, Uber's been in the news. I think what you see in great people is that, or successful people, is often that the ego that drove them to the success originally then becomes their greatest opponent and danger in maintaining that success, either professionally or personally, not being wrecked by that success. So it was trying to be like very different than every other self-help book, which tells people how awesome they are, and instead wanted to focus on the way in which people who are great and ambitious need to be worried about the dangers that are inherent in that personality type.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we celebrate, at least in Silicon Valley, is kind of the asshole, like the person that is you know, a ball buster that pushes through adversity and hires and fires at will, and is just like the you know, we've seen it through countless CEOs out here, and it's, you know, it's a thing that's celebrated. But and certainly I believe that, you know, like let's take Travis, for example, at Uber. And I've gotten to know him over the years. And one of the things that I will say was required, at least in the early days of Uber, was this drive. And, you know, when he was going against there was certainly taxi cab companies that were owned by the mafia. And mm-hmm. there were these taxi cab unions, and there were death threats. And like, there was a level of kind of just grit that you had to have about you, and the willingness to carry a baseball bat to go and fight local council and governments and, you know, people with guns. And it's like, I don't know that someone that's a little bit more passive could have dealt with those situations the way that he did. Mm-hmm. But how does one find that balance, I guess? Like, that it's hard to not say that was required.
I would be probably willing to grant that it is. The problem is when people, that becomes their default operating mode. Like, I've talked about this with a lot of basketball coaches. So there are times that a basketball coach has to either make an example out of a player to keep the team in line, or has to do has to have an outburst on the court to say, keep the team from freaking out at the refs. Like, if you ever see a coach get a technical, there's two kinds of technicals for a coach to get. One is like the coach has really actually lost their mind and cool and is freaking out, and that's not good. And then there's the other kind where the coach knows this point in the game requires me to go and do this performance, mm-hmm. right? And I think it's much healthier to be the latter than the former. And the problem is when people lose track of that distinction, if that makes sense. So it's like,
interesting,
hey,
that you look at it as like a performance, because that makes sense. Because in one sense, the coach is going out there, they're creating this performance. All the other players are looking up and saying, wow, coach is really on our team. They're fired up. And then that kind of is a pressure release for the rest of the team, right?
Yes, exactly. And it should be a pressure release for the coach too. You know, sometimes you have to get upset to get your point across as well. The problem is when that's your hammer and you see everything as a nail. I think that that's a huge problem. You know, there are people who begin, you know, because they started out with nothing, like success becomes a matter of life or death, let's say. Well, the problem is over time that becomes less and less true. And so they're really lying to themselves to keep that, like, they're keeping the intensity going, and it's getting more and more dangerous because they now have more and more to lose. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's the problem. It's like, if you're Travis and you see that you have to fight every single thing, mm-hmm. and at the beginning you do, but if you then come to believe that everyone is your enemy, you then fight things that you shouldn't fight. I'll give you a good example at American Apparel. So American Apparel is a crazy idea on the surface. And I think a lot of entrepreneurial ideas are, like, the idea that we're going to make our own clothes, we're going to do our own marketing, we're going to pay a living wage, we're going to do all these things, we're going to have our own stores. This is insanity, right? So, like, when he had this idea, everyone was like, that won't work, you're crazy. And then he didn't listen to them, and he was right. But you have to make sure that what you don't take from that, that when everyone says you're wrong, that you're right. Because sometimes, actually most of the time, when everyone is warning you against something, it's for good reason.
Right.
And so a lot of entrepreneurs do that. They as they become more successful, like early on, that ability to put up the middle finger and blow past every hater and every reservation and every warning mm-hmm. is an asset. But then once they've succeeded, they can't turn that off. Mm-hmm. And so they end up creating new dangers and new risks that they were warned against, and they proceed anyway, and then they run into some sort of catastrophic failure or difficulty that was mostly self-inflicted. Mm-hmm. One of the most insidious causes of ego is that successful people, instead of being honest about how they became successful, how accidental it was, how surprising it was, you know, how they thought this would happen, but this is what happened, or how they almost, you know, it's like we take the moment where Mark Zuckerberg turns down $1 billion from Yahoo or whatever. And because he turned it down, we now go, oh, he obviously knew. We haven't heard from him, you know, the night that he couldn't sleep before, and how he was two seconds away from saying yes, and that he was going to say yes, but somebody convinced him no, right? We don't know what actually happened. We just get the story version. And so what that does is it creates a sense of certain, a false sense of certainty that we think we're supposed to be feeling. Like I talk about, like, you know, Google, it's this company that changed the world, but really it was like two guys writing a graduate thesis that turned into a company that turned into this, that turned into that. And so when we project that they set out to change the world in this way, what that does to the up and coming entrepreneur or writer, filmmaker, whatever, is they go, oh, if the people I admired felt really certain at this point, I better pretend that I'm feeling certain at this point. And so everyone is doing this like elaborate dance where they're pretending to feel better about everything than they actually do. And that's ego. The ego is that false confidence that we feel to cover up an insecurity.
That's right.
And I think that's really dangerous.
Yeah, it's so funny. You talk to these founders and you realize, and I'm sure everyone's gone through this in their careers, is like there is no such thing as progression in a just straight line, you know? And it's not even in like an up and down line. It's like swerves and circles and like all over the place, you know? It's important to, I think, to get that out there and I think your book does a really good job at helping people realize in what the ego is and actually have practical steps that they can take. If you had to distill the book down into like some actionable things, what would you say that is practical advice for people to implement in their everyday life?
Honestly, I think the easiest way to combat the ego is to, the two easiest ones are, one, have some sort of mentor or model for your life that's way better than you in like every way. So for me, it's the author Robert Greene, who wrote The 48 Laws of Power. He was the first person I really worked for. You know, he taught me how to write. I dream that one day I will be as good at this craft as he is. And so that keeps me humble because I have something to compare myself to in a non-materialistic way. And I have someone I can go to for advice. I have someone I can defer to. You know, when I got an offer to do a book when I was like 22 or 23, and Robert was like, I don't think you're ready. And like every part of me wanted to say yes, and my ego would have said yes. But like listening to someone who could see it a little bit more objectively, that helped me. And so I had to do a lot more work before I ended up writing my first book. So I think that's part of it. And then I would say another easy sort of hack, I guess, would be, you know, experiencing things that are much bigger than you as well. So travel is a way to do that. You know, nature, like it's very hard standing in Yosemite to be consumed with any egotistical or petty concern, or, you know, it's very hard, you know, when I walk out in the fields on my farm and I'm, you know, petting my donkey or something, I don't feel
Please tell me you actually have a donkey.
I have three. That's three donkeys. You know, it's a different kind of experience that takes you out of the one where you might think that you're the center of the universe, mm-hmm. is I guess what I'm saying. And so I think cultivating those experiences, one of the Stoic academics, his name was Pierre Hadot, he would call this the oceanic feeling. Like, you know, what you feel standing next to the ocean is not like, I'm fucking awesome, right? You're like, the ocean is awesome. And you want those experiences.
How do you seek out, you had mentioned mentors a second ago.
Yeah.
What if you say, okay, there's people listening and say, my mentor is Elon Musk. And like that, that's not going to be, you know, their best friend, at least not right away. How do you find someone that you can actually connect with and get mentorship from?
Sure. And I would say Elon Musk is probably a bad model, not because he's like a bad person or something. I don't know him. But that's the point, is like we don't know him. Like it's you have no idea whether he's like a nice person or not. You have no idea whether he's happy or not. He could be sitting in his mansion like Howard Hughes, utterly miserable and a prisoner of his own success. So I think ideally you want to pick people that are either long dead, and so you're just studying certain parts of them or whatever, or their past is well documented, or you want to study someone you know who has the life that you want. And I think, again, the life you want, not materialistically, but fully the life you want. They're the kind of person that you want to be. I don't know. I don't have like a magical formula for getting a mentor, but I do find that the way you connect with those people is by reaching out and asking questions. You know, it's not, hey, will you be my mentor? Let's talk on the phone every Tuesday at 3 p.m. Mm-hmm. But it's like, hey, I'm struggling with this thing. I know you're very busy. Could you give me one sentence of advice? You know, and it's from that interaction that a fuller relationship can bloom.
I think that's solid advice. You know, I've gotten a lot of responses to my newsletter going out to these folks, and you know, I get emails back, and when it's very kind of well defined. And like, I have this problem. Can you give me your 2 second like opinion?
Right.
Then it's much easier for me to respond versus reading like a really long, you know, multi-page little essay on something. So I think that's a really good way to reach out to people.
And if you ask a smart question and then follow it up a couple weeks later with another smart question, and then over a year you've asked 5 or 6 smart questions, people start to think you're smart. Mm-hmm. You know, like that's the kind of person you would invest in if you'd had a 5 or 6 email conversations with a young kid about something, and then he or she asked you to recommend them for a position at a startup that you were an investor in. That's where these things start to happen.
Exactly. Or they say, hey, I happen to be in town for a couple of days. Do you have, you know, a half hour for a coffee? Let's grab.
Exactly.
You know, and when you've had that 5 or 6 conversations going on, then it's much easier to say yes.
Right, because it's much less likely that it'll be a total waste of your time or weird or uncomfortable or whatever.
Exactly. All right, one last question for you.
Okay.
What are you struggling with today? I mean, you seem to have with the Daily Stoic and Ego is the Enemy and, you know, these whole slew of books that are,
sure.
I'm assuming you're going to say nothing and you have it all figured out.
No, that would be a very unphilosophical answer. I would say two things. One, I tend to, even though I talked about an ego, I tend to overcommit and spread myself too thin.
We all do that. Have you read Essentialism?
I have. I love that book. I'm just really bad at it.
Yeah, that's a great one for helping with that.
Yeah, so I tend to overcommit, especially because the kind of work I do is very start and stop. So it's like there's a gap, and instead of appreciating the gap, I fill it with something, and I don't anticipate how it's going to come back to me later. And then I would say related to that, but, you know, having a kid, it sort of focuses you. It makes you realize that it's not all about you and that, you know, there's these other concerns. And so I'm struggling with like, what does my life look like, you know, day to day? What do I want it to look like? And am I getting caught up in inessential things at the expense of essential things? So it's still the same problem, but one's professional and one is personal.
Yeah. Well, on the professional side, can you go a little bit deeper there? Like, are you working on a new book? Like where are you going? Yeah. Where are you heading with that?
Yeah. I mean, I have a book out on July 18th. Then I have another book out in the fall.
Wait, which one's coming July 18th?
I have a book called The Perennial Seller, which is about books that stand the books and art and projects that stand the test of time.
Awesome. I'm going to check
and then out. I'm doing this. I'll send you one. And then I'm doing this journal, and then I'm doing an updated version of one of my books. And then I agree to too many things because I think they're off in the future. And then at some point that bill comes due. And then I'm like, what was I thinking?
Yeah. I do that with social functions.
Yes.
We'll just agree to do this party or go to this event. And then the day that it comes along, I'm just like, why did I sign up for that?
Yeah, completely. I have a note that a really smart person who works with a lot of athletes sort of told me that I should do. I wrote this down. It says questions to ask. And it's right on my computer right here. It says, how much of this decision is motivated by not wanting to disappoint people? And what would I say about this at 80 years old? And so I try to use that when I'm saying yes or no to things. And then he gave me this picture of Oliver Sacks. It's Oliver Sacks' office. And there's a giant picture on the wall of Sacks' office. It just says no in all caps with an exclamation point. And so I try to think about that with these things. I still end up overcommitting, but I'm getting better at it.
Cool. Well, Ryan, thank you so much for being on the show. This was a fun episode.
Thank you.
Where can people find you if they want to read more? I know they should sign up for your Daily Stoic email newsletter. Is that the main thing that they should be signing up for?
Yeah. And you can just go, to my website, which is ryanholiday.net, and my books are there and all my social stuff is there too.
That is it for this episode. Thanks again to Ryan Holiday for being on the show. If you're listening this far, then that means you likely enjoyed the episode, in which I would love it if you could head on over to iTunes, search for The Kevin Rose Show, and leave a 5-star review. That would mean a lot. It also helps us get a little bit more distribution on iTunes, get more listeners. So thank you so much, and we'll see you again soon.